It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back in the air with me tomorrow. And tomorrow, we want to hear some of your Father's Day stories, a lesson you learned from your father, great advice maybe you got from your father, or advice you hope to impart to your children if you're a dad. You can leave a message right now at 855-683-5422. That's 855-683-5422. Tell us the best lesson you learned from your dad. We'll play your pieces of advice, your lessons on the air tomorrow. Again, 855-683-5422. Coming up yet today, we'll take a look at a recently released poll showing opposition to public funding for a new basketball arena and entertainment center in Milwaukee. First, our next guest says our government drug policy is a little bit upside down. Instead of fighting to stop the flow of drugs and to keep drugs from people who want them, he says the government should consider promoting the innovation of new drugs that meet people's desire for an altered state of consciousness without the downsides, the negatives that many drugs carry with them. Greg Beato is a columnist and contributing editor for Reason Magazine, where his piece, The DIY Drug Prize, appeared. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, as part of the problem you're trying to solve, you say the war on drugs as we know it has been a moral issue as much as a medical issue. Why did that happen, and what's wrong with that way of thinking about recreational drugs?
Well, I think why it happened was because they needed to create a context for, you know, sort of an all-out effort to say that drugs are bad. Once you're going to say that they're illegal, you have to then say they're bad. That helps, you know, kind of keep the enforcement efforts coherent. But that's what is kind of odd about the whole thing. It's like, what is it that the government is actually trying to solve? What's the problem we're trying to solve by making certain recreational drugs illegal? Is it a health issue? Is it a, you know, just a social order issue, or is it a moral issue? And, you know, as I say in my piece, I talk about how when the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy introduced its first paper that it wrote 25 years ago, and when it became an agency, it talked about there being this crisis of national character, and that was why the federal government was spearheading this new effort to reduce drug usage. And in my estimation, the federal government should not be trying to say, you know, we need to make our citizens better people. At the most, they should be saying we need to do what we can to create a healthier, more orderly society. And so if that's really what we're trying to solve through some type of drug control efforts, is there a better way to do that than what they've been doing for the last 25 to 50 years, which is essentially trying to cut off demand and cut off supply?
And you say kind of at the bottom of this, there are always going to be some people who have a desire for some kind of altered state of consciousness in recreational drug form. That's not going to go away anytime soon?
Yeah, I think it's more than some people. It's a profound human urge. You know, I talk about this book by this UCLA psychopharmacologist, Ronald Siegel. He wrote it in 1989, so it's not a new book, but he describes, you know, our human urge for drugs as a fourth drive. It's just as powerful as our drive for, you know, hunger, thirst, and sex. It's one of the primary types of human behavior. And if you look, you know, across history at different cultures, there's almost always, you know, some sort of intoxicant that is created. It's a primary, primal human urge and pastime.
Well, what you're hoping to see is some kind of innovation to meet that desire that you're saying is a primal urge without the harm that comes along with it. There is some innovation now, you write, a lot of synthetic alternatives to the drugs that are currently banned. What's the state of the market there?
Yeah, well, right now what's happening is, you know, as technology gets distributed and people can create more and more sophisticated labs in, you know, whether it's their homes or in various sort of commercial or semi-commercial environments, you've got an incredible amount of experimentation and development of synthetic drugs that are going on to the point where, you know, the Congress, which tracks this, is, you know, seeing hundreds of new drugs come on the market. And, you know, a new substance isn't immediately illegal. We have to make it illegal, turn it into a Schedule I drug. So a lot of times these things will be developed because they, you know, they take a structure and they alter it chemically to make it something that hasn't been declared illegal already, and then they sort of semi-licitly sell it until it gets declared illegal. So now, you know, the government is trying to, there's some interest in trying to change the laws, and some of the laws have been changed to kind of preclude or preempt this type of activity, but it's not going to go away. This is a, you know, an issue that goes beyond making new drugs. It's as technology gets distributed and more sophisticated, and as we have better and better ways to connect with each other and engage in transactions, whether it's Bitcoin or whatever, it's going to be harder and harder for the government to police activities it wants to control in the ways that it always has. It's, you know, it's losing its ability to do that. So what it needs to start doing is thinking about what are new ways that we might achieve positive outcomes that we want, but that don't depend on our ability to suppress and control various things, because their ability to do that is eroding.
And you point toward New Zealand as taking a different approach. What are they doing there when it comes to these synthetic drugs?
Yeah, last year they passed some legislation, and it actually just kicked in, I think, in May of this year. They have this whole protocol. They've created a regulatory agency. It's called the Psychoactive Substances Regulatory Authority. And what drug developers can do there now is they can apply to get a license to develop drugs. And then if they test them and if they meet certain standards, they can legally market these new drugs. And so this, you know, they spell it all out in sort of long, lengthy guides of what sort of conditions the drugs must be manufactured under, what sort of reporting requirements there are, and what kind of results they've got. They have to do extensive testing that supposedly will end up costing around $1 million to $2 million per product. So this is not really something that you're going to be able to do in, you know,
your backyard lab or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
In a shack.
It's definitely a professional level thing. And, you know, theoretically, it will just then put recreational drugs through the same sort of processes that we use for medicinal drugs. And by the time they hit the market, they'll generally have been proven to be effective at doing what they say they're going to do and work. You know, there will still be the chance of side effects, just like there's the chance of side effects for drugs for heartburn and keeping your blood pressure down.
And Greg, that takes us to the point that you're looking for here. Your article is titled The DIY Drug Prize. You want to see the U.S. federal government and your modest proposal promote innovation of new, less harmful recreational drugs. What would that look like?
Well, I think we could go a step further than New Zealand. New Zealand's saying, okay, here's the path that you can do this, but it's not necessarily incentivizing people to do it. I think we have, you know, a lot of companies basically that could throw a lot of resources at this problem by trying to develop drugs that were safer, that were easier to predict what happens with them. We don't incentivize them to do that. In fact, we do the opposite. We tell them, don't do anything that will create a drug that has just recreational euphoric effects. If you do that, we're going to make it illegal. So I'm saying, instead of disincentivizing these people, let's, say, actually, we want you to try to do this. And the reason, the way we're going to incent you is we're going to have a $1 billion prize. If you come up with a drug that we, deem to be, that you can show to be truly very risk-free and yet still provides these sort of intoxicating effects that people like, you win the prize. And this is, a technique that the federal government has actually been using more and more over the last 5 years or so. Almost every department in the federal government now is sponsoring a prize of some sort. The Google driverless car grew out of a prize that was initially offered by the Defense Department to develop an autonomous self-driving vehicle. The DEA is, or not the DEA, the I'm blanking on the name, but there's prizes that are being offered to develop a better light bulb, a better, more effective, fuel-efficient car, that kind of thing.
We're talking to Greg Beato with Reason Magazine. In a recent piece, he says the government should, as he just mentioned, fund a prize to promote the creation of safe, less risky, risk-free, ideally, recreational drugs. What do you think of this idea? Is this a good alternative to the ongoing war on drugs? Or is there something inherently wrong with the act of getting high or intoxicated, even if we could strip away the danger and risk of addiction? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org. We continue our conversation now with Greg Beato of Reason Magazine. In a recent piece, he makes the case that the federal government should fund a prize to develop a safe, legal, recreational drug. He says it's a better alternative than putting more money into the ongoing war on drugs. And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. If there were a legal, reasonably safe recreational drug with little or no downside, would you use it? Could it replace maybe alcohol in your life? Good idea, bad idea, what do you think? Call now at 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. We'll talk a little more about how the competition might work to get that prize. First, we'll go to Lisa on the line in Milwaukee. Lisa, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I think this is a really interesting idea just because, we have so many issues that we see with alcohol. And so many problems that come from it, whether it's alcohol dependency, health problems related to alcohol consumption, even some people that drink a moderate amount of alcohol can end up with health effects years down the road. And yet it's something that's legal in our society just because it's always been there. We've seen through history that we can't take away alcohol. We can't make it illegal. So why not work on developing something that is less dangerous than alcohol, but still has those same kind of effects.
Lisa, thanks a lot for the call. Greg, is that part of the line of reasoning? We've got this substance that's legal, but especially in a place like Wisconsin, we definitely see harms associated with drinking and driving, for example. This might give us a safer alternative?
Yeah, well, I think what Lisa said was correct, is that it's really hard to make something illegal. Prohibition showed us that was the case. And that was at a time when, it was still probably a lot easier than it would be now. Like, prohibition now would be orders of magnitude more disastrous because of people's greater ability to just make what they wanted and distribute what they wanted. So all the problems that we saw with prohibition in the 1920s, 1930s would be more so. So, instead of trying to keep some part of that prohibitionist mindset as what's driving our approach to drugs, what could we do differently?
Let's get in a little more to how this government-funded prize to develop a better recreational drug might work. Who, you mentioned, I think, pharmaceutical companies. Who do you see picking up the gauntlet and trying to win this prize?
Well, yeah, like I said, it would not. I'm sure they would want to structure it in a way that only relatively large, sophisticated organizations would be able to participate. Whether that's a good thing or a fair thing, I'm not sure. But typically, when you are developing drugs, there's this whole, you know, process that you go through. And by drugs, I mean any type of medicinal drug, where you first do testing on animals, then it goes to cohorts of individuals. It's a long, lengthy process. So anyone that's going to be able to do that and also doing it in a somewhat controlled environment, you know, because they're going to also want to have various sort of safety things in place if they're tacitly endorsing this activity, it's not going to be really that DIY. And against
but could you see a kind of a startup sort of silicon? I mean, there are startup biotech firms out there who at least start the ball rolling maybe before it gets picked up by a pharmaceutical giant. Could you see that kind of being a first step here?
Sure. And you know, just as far as funding it on the other end of it, my point is not that I expect the government to all of a sudden, you know, stop doing what it currently does. It currently spends $25 billion a year pretty regularly, you know, trying to either reduce the supply or reduce the demand of drugs. And what I'm saying is instead of, you know, you could divert a small amount of that money each year and put it into a prize pot or pool. And, you know, if someone actually comes up with a solution that works, then you give them the prize. So you're not paying for anything until you actually have a solution, and you're not actually, you know, needing any more money than for the problem, because we're just taking some money from that $25 billion a year that really isn't doing a whole lot. You know, if you look at where we are in the quote-unquote war on drugs now versus where we were 25 years ago, we haven't really made that much progress. You have a lot of people in jail. You have pretty steady rates over time of how many people do drugs. It hasn't really made a dent.
Let's go back to our callers now. We've got Adam on the line in Whitewater. Adam, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What do you think?
I just wanted to make a comment on the whole prize for a safe drug. I just don't really, I find the concept kind of silly. I mean, we're dealing with a federal government who, as of right now, still categorizes cannabis as a Schedule I drug. And for them to go out and start giving a prize for something, it just doesn't really seem possible to me. We have a substance that is relatively safe. You can, through the process of vaporization of cannabis, there's not that many medical side effects that are coming out right now. So I think until we kind of look at what's going on now in the country, I just don't really see a prize for an even newer substance as something possible in the near future.
Adam, thanks for the call. And Greg, in your piece, you use the phrase, you know, you'll be accused of this being a pipe dream. Is it?
Well, it's, you know, I'd say it's somewhat improbable. I don't expect that the government will embrace the idea. I present it as a way to just, you know, create conversation around the topic and also just sort of clarify what the government's sort of stance and strategy is.
And ultimately, you're hoping to see maybe more thought about harm reduction, maybe less of a moral emphasis in anti-drug efforts.
Absolutely.
All right, Greg, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
We've been hearing from Greg Beato. He's a columnist and contributing editor for Reason Magazine. That's where the piece appeared that we've been talking about, a prize for DIY drugs. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickett will be back on the air with me tomorrow. Coming up in Wisconsin Legends, a look at the life and political career of Fighting Bob La Follette, governor, senator, progressive candidate for president, among other things. First, a new poll out today from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Center for Urban Initiatives and Research finds that 63% of Milwaukee metro residents oppose state funding for a new arena for the Milwaukee Bucks, and 53% oppose spending state money on development of infrastructure related to a new arena. Could be bad news for the future of the franchise in the city. Previous reports have suggested that a new arena is key to keeping the Bucks in Milwaukee. Our next guest is confident, though, that a deal for an arena can be struck and could pay dividends for the city. We're joined now by Tim Sheehy, president of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce. Tim, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be with you this afternoon.
So this new poll, 63% of residents in the Milwaukee metro area opposed to state funding for a new arena, a higher percentage opposed when you look statewide. Bad news from your perspective. What's your reaction?
No, I don't think it's bad news. Especially in the Milwaukee area here, the survey only asked 162 people, and the 53-45 spread is within the 8-point margin of error. And I really think for local politics here, if you took out the Racine area, which nobody is expecting to participate in the financing of a new downtown arena, you would change the results of that survey. But the point is, we've got a lot of work to do. It's very early on, and we need to make a compelling case, and I think we can do that.
For people who are unconvinced, what's the case you think you need to make to them?
Sure. The case I think that we need to make is that we have, as a region, as a metropolitan area, you can expand it further as a state, we're in a race to improve our economic prosperity. And there are going to be clearly winners and losers in that race. And Milwaukee is the flagship city, as a flagship region in Wisconsin, accounts for more than a third of the state's revenues, more than a third of the state's population, and more than a third of the state's economy. And what is going to make this region successful is our ability to attract and retain and develop the diverse talent that our economy needs. And if we're going to do that, part of the emphasis we have to place is on reinvesting in our cultural and entertainment assets that help make this an attractive location for the kind of talent that's going to drive growth in our future. And we view that a downtown entertainment center that can draw in excess of 2 million visitors, has a significant economic impact, and puts us on a global stage is an asset that's worth investing in, both private and public dollars.
And you've used the phrase entertainment center. Is this just going to be a place for the Bucks to play basketball? If not, what else will this be used for?
Sure. I mean, the Bucks are clearly the marquee name on it, as it's an NBA arena. But there are only 40 dates that an NBA team plays in a market. And so when I call it a downtown entertainment center, it is truly the appropriate moniker for a venue like this. There are concerts that are brought in from national concerts, from the national concert circuit, that won't stop here without a venue. There are community events. There are meetings. It's a facility that's used 200-plus days a year. And I think in a re-envisioned and new facility, it could connect even better with the community than it does right now. And all that activity brings in new dollars to the state. It brings in new revenue. Just as one example, the basketball players that play in the arena produce almost $7 million a year in income tax for the state alone. So there are lots of economic spinoffs from this kind of an investment.
A lot of people look at public money for a sports arena and entertainment venue in this case and say, hey, there's a lot of money in the league for the owners, the players. Why do we need to tap into public funds to help build it?
Yeah, and it's a great question. And of the last Over the last 15 years, there have been 13 NBA facilities built. The average public sector contribution is 69%. I think we're gonna beat that significantly, and we should with a larger private sector share. But these communities all over the United States are doing this because it is a unique business. It's an attractive asset for a community. It puts those communities that have it, there are only 27 in the United States, it puts them on a global stage, and they have made the decision, and we're going to have to make the similar decision, is it worth some kind of public support? And again, I think the public support here will be far less than what other communities have had to do.
Are you looking at just state coffers being tapped here or some kind of regional tax? What exactly would be the form of the public money?
Well, again, I think we're looking at a combination of the best way to do this. We have talked about the potential of a sales tax. The advantage to that is that a third of that is going to be paid by residents who don't live here. That's a very positive thing. I just gave you an idea of how the state benefits from the tax revenue generated from this activity. So that's a possibility. And I think that your listeners need to know that the current entertainment center, the Bradley Center, is a state-owned facility. And it's a state-owned facility that for most of its 25 years has drawn no revenue from the state of Wisconsin. It's only recently, in the last couple years, that the state has begun to put in some money to help maintain a facility that it is the owner of, for lack of a better word. So as we look forward to the next 25 or 30 years, that facility could require $100 to $125 million in upkeep and investment. And so part of the question we're asking, is that a smart investment for the state, or are we better putting something like that into a new facility that will give us a better chance to be successful?
There has been talk from community groups in Milwaukee over the last couple of months saying, in effect, if we're going to put lots of money in for the Bucks to play basketball, can this project include new, improved, rehabilitated recreational facilities for kids in Milwaukee? Can you see that being rolled into the project?
Well, what I can see and what I see right now is a vibrant discussion in this community about what we need to do to remain attractive, to develop the talent we have, and to attract people into the area and into the region. And so this is not just about a new place to play basketball. We have a vibrant discussion here about how we fund our cultural institutions, the zoo, the museum, the Performing Arts Center, our parks. All those are vital assets, and I think this is a much broader discussion for us at the local level here in the Milwaukee area that extends beyond just a new downtown entertainment center. And we're just beginning that conversation, but we're very pleased with the reaction I think we're getting so far.
The similar battle over Miller Park a while back led to a state senator being recalled pretty much over that one issue. Are politicians, do you think, going to be willing to stick their necks out to support public funding of this new arena?
Yeah, and I happened to be sitting in George Petak's office before he walked out to take that vote, and I think it was a courageous thing to do.
No kidding.
He may have painted himself into a bit of a box by saying he wasn't going to vote for it, but I think if you look back at the situation we had at the time, drawing a little over 1.5 million people to County Stadium, you had a team that wasn't playing very well. The league was about to go on strike, and the prospects were not very bright. I'll fast forward to today. The Brewers are 5 games ahead in the division, and I think you would be hard-pressed to find anybody in the Milwaukee area who doesn't think Miller Park was a fantastic investment, that it's a great asset for the region, and what it's cost most residents in the region, they probably have more change that's fallen out of their pocket under their car seats than it cost them for that kind of an investment.
What does the community lose? What does the Milwaukee region lose if the Bucks ultimately don't get the stadium and move elsewhere?
I don't think Milwaukee is a one-horse town. It is not dependent solely on the Brewers or the Bucks or the Symphony or the Public Museum or our park system. But what we lose is we take a step back, that this community has had an NBA team for 35-plus years. It's been an asset. It's part of our it's part of what we sell. And I'm a big believer that we should take care of our assets and reduce our liabilities. And I don't want to see us go backwards by losing an asset that we have. And I think a modest public investment as a part of the private sector investment going in here will help secure that asset for us going forward and allow us to build and repair some of the other public institutions that need support.
Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet. Anytime.
That was Tim Sheehy, president of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce. This weekend is the birthday of Wisconsin legend Robert M. La Follette Sr., better known as Fighting Bob. He was a man who touched a lot of bases in Wisconsin politics, serving as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, U.S. Senator from Wisconsin, and governor of the state. And he ran for president of the United States as the nominee of the Progressive Party in 1924. As Wisconsin gears up for another gubernatorial election, we'll look back on the influential career of Fighting Bob La Follette. Our guest is Jonathan Kasparek. He's professor of history at the UW-Waukesha and author of Fighting Phil, a biography of Philip La Follette. Welcome to Central Time.
Thanks.
So how did Fighting Bob's experience growing up in Wisconsin as a student at UW-Madison influence his politics?
Well, he was the first governor born in the state, grew up in Dane County, and the first to attend the University of Wisconsin, where he was actually quite a bad student. he was a good student, I should say, just not in the classroom.
Right. Did he have trouble making it all the way through college, given his poor classroom experience?
Well, it was a very close thing. In those days, the faculty met and voted individually on each graduate, and he had a tie vote until President John Bascom decided that he should pass. So he became part of the class of 1879.
So squeaking through college, how did he then get into politics?
Well, he built on what he did in college. He wasn't a great student academically, but he was a very popular student and learned that he had a knack for organizing. He bought the student paper and began organizing a political campaign for student government. He became the winner of an interstate oratorical competition and became a campus hero. So he learned that he had the ability to motivate people to speak and speak well.
And then what was his first foray into electoral politics, trying to get into office?
His first elected office was district attorney of Dane County in 1880, after he had been a lawyer for just over a year. And he did it mostly because he needed the money at an $800 salary, I think, and that was what he wanted.
Now, over time, he became involved with the state's Republican Party, but he wasn't apparently wild about the direction the party was taking. How did he become an agitator?
He became an agitator early on. The story that he tells in 1880, he decides he's going to run for district attorney and has a confrontation with the postmaster of Madison, Elisha Keyes, who said, "I hear you're running for district attorney, and we have somebody else lined up already." La Follette decided that he wasn't going to let any one person stand in his way, so he started doing the rounds. He went to every farm in Dane County that he could and met all the voters and got the nomination over the boss.
And was this pretty much a one-party state at that point? If you got the Republican nomination, you were more or less a shoo-in?
It really was, and I think that's where the Republicans really ran a risk, because they started taking voters for granted. And La Follette learned that if he appealed directly to the voters on a one-to-one basis and went out and shook hands, he could convince them that he would be more interested and look out for their interests better than the party bosses that they'd been voting for.
So apart from working against the party, I don't think we could call it a machine quite, but what issues was he starting to take up around that time in that district attorney race and ones that followed soon after?
When he's running for district attorney, and then later when he serves in the House of Representatives, he's not really an insurgent yet. He's a pretty typical Republican. He is a law and order Republican. The big issue in the 1880 election was what they called the tramp menace, too many unemployed men from the Depression of 1873 roaming the countryside. When he's in the House of Representatives, he votes as Republicans do for a high tariff. You get a little glimmer of his independent streak. Some of the lumber interest and the railroad interest in Wisconsin saw the Menominee Reservation as a great source of timber, and he kind of stopped them from getting that land. But he's not really an insurgent yet. The big change comes in 1891.
What happened then?
1890 is an unusual year. It's the one of the few years that the Republicans lose, and the Democrats suddenly find themselves with the governorship, the legislature, and most of the congressional delegation, and LaFollette finds himself unemployed. It turns out that the Republicans had been engaging in a kind of a nice graft. They had the control of the treasurer's office, and they kept the interest on all of the state's deposits and used it kind of as a party slush fund. When the Democrats took over in 1891, they filed a lawsuit to reclaim all of that money, and a lot of Republicans stood to lose a lot. And one of those Republicans is the former U.S. Senator Philetus Sawyer, who summons young Bob LaFollette to Milwaukee for a meeting, pulls out a wad of cash and says, "Here, you need to fix this." And LaFollette assumed that he's being offered a bribe to influence the case, which is being held in a Dane County courtroom in a court presided over by his brother-in-law. So suddenly he realizes politics are corrupt and decides that he's going to be the crusader against corruption.
So at what point, that kicked off a long career on issues of corruption and the influence of money in politics, where did he get the nickname Fighting Bob?
Because he kept fighting. He goes to the Republican state conventions. He wants to run for governor, and the bosses keep pushing him down through one case, the bribery, in another case, they rigged the convention against him. And he keeps going back every 2 years to fight them. And he's very strident. He won't compromise. He wants to be elected, and he wants to be a reformer.
How effective, when he finally made it into the governor's office, how effective was he there? Did he have to compromise a lot once he was in the governor's chair?
He didn't really compromise a whole lot. But back then, of course, governors were two-year terms, so he's up for re-election in 1902 right away. Didn't actually get a lot done his first term because he refused to compromise. So he goes over the politician's head and campaigns and tells people, if you want to get anything done, vote for candidates who will support my agenda. Hmm. And he's much more successful in his second term when he gets tax reform in place, what was called ad valorem taxation, where the railroads and other corporations would be taxed on the value of their property. He gets a primary election law passed where the voters will choose a candidate for the party rather than a convention. So he does get what he wants, and mostly because he refuses to compromise.
Then he goes on to the U.S. Senate, and I've seen lists that historians and some others have done of most influential, important senators in history, and he is often up there on that list. What was his legacy in the Senate?
His great legacy in the Senate really is to continue being the spokesperson for farmers, working men, people who really have been left out of the great prosperity of the Gilded Age. He's probably most famous for opposing U.S. entry into World War I, which almost ruined his career, but not quite.
And then looking ahead, you've written about fighting Phil. How did his family carry on his political agenda?
Well, Phil, of course, goes on to be elected governor in 1930 and has a whole host of reforms that he introduces as well, including the nation's first unemployment compensation law that goes on to become kind of a blueprint for the rest of the country. His son, Bob Jr., becomes senator in 1925 and serves until 1946 and is also very well regarded as one of the greatest U.S. senators.
And let's talk about his legacy in just the last couple of decades. I've certainly heard Democrats style themselves as the heir to Fighting Bob. I've seen a couple of Republicans paint themselves as mavericks, too. People who are willing to buck their own party. Do people still want to pick up the mantle of Fighting Bob in Wisconsin?
Well, Wisconsin voters seem to really like those kinds of politicians that are willing to be independent. And you're right, both Democrats and Republicans sort of claim that insurgency and that populism. Bill Proxmire was a great example of that throughout his career. We've seen it in others as well.
We'll leave it there for now. A lot more that we didn't get to. Thank you for spending time with us today.
I'm glad to do it.
That's Jonathan Kasparek. He's a historian at UW-Waukesha and author of Fighting Phil, a biography of Philip La Follette. We've been talking about the life, political career, and legacy of Fighting Bob La Follette. His birthday, the anniversary of his birthday, is this Saturday.